Tom Woods Show, episode 893.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you shavers out there, Harry's wants to send you a free trial set. Razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Best shave you ever had, just pay for shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. This is a great little episode here because it's a conversation I had with Brett Vinat, who hosts the School Sucks podcast. And before you say, hey, education is important, that's exactly his point. He's saying there's a difference between traditional American schooling and education. He's in favor of the second one. Well, anyway, he's got a terrific podcast. You can check it out at schoolsucksproject.com. Anyway, he came to my event at Yale, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now. It was an event that was like a debate. You really have to attend a Yale Political Union event to get what the whole thing is about. But I went there and argued in favor of a resolution supporting the idea of state secession. I want to talk about something controversial, and I thought, this is about as tame a controversial thing as I believe, so this is a good toe in the water for these Yale types, and it was such a great event. They're still trying to get me video and audio, official video and audio. The trouble was the microphones weren't working, and so I don't know how good the quality is going to be. They don't really make much of an effort to record these things. If you go to YouTube and you type in Yale Political Union, almost nothing comes up, even though they do this every single week. There is an amateur recording of the event. I'm just waiting to see if I can get something a little bit better, because the sound quality, particularly with the acoustics in that room, is just not ideal. But I really would like you to hear at least the ending part where I got to address all the people who had criticized my position. That was just glorious. I mean, if I don't get a good, high-quality official recording at some point, I will at least play you what I have one of these days, once I get a definitive word from the Yale Political Union. Anyway, Brett Vinat, great guy. He came to the event. He and I went out for dinner afterward. And then after that, we went back to my hotel room and recorded this episode of his podcast. So we pretty much recorded up until 1 in the morning. I had been up at some heaven knows what time it was, I guess. But it was very, very early that morning, and I had barely slept. So it's a miracle that this happened at all. And then I had to get up in 4 hours to get ready to go to the airport and go back. So this was rough, but yet I think it came out pretty well. So we're talking about things like, well, college life and schooling and the sorts of things that would be interesting to his podcast audience. But as it goes on, I think it gets better and better as it goes on, because by the end, we're talking about some somewhat personal things and some struggles I've had in the past that I think I've more or less overcome, but that may be of some benefit to some of you folks. So having said that, I will simply add that the occasion for the interview was not simply my appearance at Yale, but also the release of my little ebook, Sane Space, subtitle Libertarian Dispatches from Bizarro America. You can get that at sanespacebook.com. Doesn't cost you anything. And we were talking about that. We were using that as something to riff on. So here we go with the tremendous fun episode that gets better and better as it goes along of the School Sucks podcast, featuring your host here.
Tom, welcome back to School Sucks podcast.
Glad to be here, Brett.
And thank you for trusting me in your hotel room past midnight.
It's just crazy sometimes what you wind up doing for this movement.
What a day, though. Let's set the scene. We are looking out a window here at the Yale University campus. You came here to speak about secession.
Yeah, I was invited by the Yale Political Union, and generally they want to speak about controversial stuff, and genuinely controversial stuff. I mean, it even passes my test, and I think most debates are pretty tame, but they talk about controversial stuff. So I picked secession. They told me I could choose a topic, not because it's the most radical thing I could talk about, but because it's a topic that I felt sure I would know more about than anybody in the room. And if I'm going to speak at Yale and in a debate setting, that's where I want to be on my strongest suit. So I think you'll agree with me, Brett. It was a highly unusual event. It goes on every single Tuesday night, though. They do this every week. It's amazing. And it was an event where I speak for 20 to 30 minutes, And then I take questions for about 15 minutes. And by the way, while I'm talking, people who agree with me are banging the seat.
Mm-hmm.
And people who don't agree are hissing. And this is what they do to everybody. They do it to each other. Then after the questions, individual students come up and they have prepared statements. They have students from 7 different parties at Yale, the party of the right, the conservative party, the party of the left, the liberal party. They got all these different parties. And they got people from each of these. They come up, they give a statement. People ask them questions. People give rebuttals. It's totally crazy. And then meanwhile, I'm taking notes. And at the end, I get the final word. And it was just great. I mean, if I may say so, I gave a completely blistering final word where I responded to the various students and I had fun. I did it in sort of a roast style. I really let them have it. When they were wrong, I let them know they were wrong. But everybody got along. It was all friendly. It was all in good fun. We all learned something. We talked about something controversial. Everything I just said just now, almost none of that ever happens at an American college. I have to hand it to Yale. That was a very impressive thing.
Well, as we were walking back from eating some dinner, I pointed out to you that the location of this event was right across the street from where that whole Halloween costume student yells at the professor. That was right across the street from this location. And I was saying to the organizer, Brian, afterwards, I'm so impressed with what I saw here tonight because so many of us are outsiders and we've developed this kind of caricature of not just Yale, but of academia in general, that this kind of thing doesn't happen there. And as I mentioned this to you before, you said, don't make that the new rule. This was rare.
We don't want to go the other extreme and say, oh, I guess universities are better than we thought. Only Yale is better than we thought. I have never seen a university that puts on an event like this, much less every single week, week in and week out. And they are going to be having other Misesian style libertarians as speakers coming up soon. So they've got Jill Stein coming, they've got Bobby Jindal coming, people from all over the spectrum to talk about all different things. And it was just a blast. And it was wonderful. I got to meet a whole bunch of Yale students who listened to the Tom Woods Show. How about that?
Completely. I said I wanted to talk about your new book, Sane Space. That was probably inspired by the opposite of what we saw tonight to a large degree, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been doing a lot of writing about what goes on college campuses because for some reason I don't know why that of all things really sets me off. That and mass murder, those are the two things
right.
that get me really upset. And I realized that in the daily email newsletter that I send out, and when I say daily, it's sort of in quotation marks, because on a day like today, there was no way I was going to be able to get a newsletter out. I was here at Yale, and it was just crazy. But all the same, I noticed there was a theme in a lot of what I'd been writing, which was, it's just unbelievable what goes on the campuses, and in particular, the attitude among some students that really it's impossible to have a different view from the one they have. That only people of bad will could have a view other than the one they have. So they have absolutely no incentive for any introspection whatsoever. Why bother? Because they can't possibly be wrong. And it's just such a depressing attitude. And what I like is I like doing the opposite of what these people want. These people want their safe space. I like, to the contrary, to be debating or talking about things that everybody assumes were settled years ago. I like to rip them back open again, to discombobulate these people, get them off balance, make them think even things they once thought were sacred and cherished are now being questioned once again. Like the idea of secession. Well, that was decided 150 years ago.
Sure.
Not so fast, buddy. Woods is here to talk about it again. I like to just rip, just tear things open again. But yeah, so I put together a little ebook for free where I share some of my thoughts or and sometimes it's fun. Sometimes I have a good time getting back to these people. But also there's some good, decent information in there too that you can use if you're ever in the unfortunate situation of finding yourself up against one of these people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've felt a lot of my attention going that way too, towards what's happening on college campuses. And one of the things I'm interested in your thoughts on this as well, but one of the things I start to worry about is like, am I doing this because this is just like automatically self-generating comedy and it's so easy to line up against so much of what we're seeing? It's so ridiculous. What have you explored your attraction or other people's attraction to it at all?
To some degree, I suppose there is the element of this is such an easy news item to report on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going on everywhere and it's easy to find sources that will give you stories about this stuff. But for me, the main reason is my worry of what happens to American society when the sort of people who pull stunts like we see on the campuses are in charge of everything. And when everybody else has been taught to be cowed into silence by these people. That's why I generally support provocateur type speakers, even if I don't always agree with them, simply because this pattern where the social justice warrior left, they all get their way and people are just intimidated into silence, is a very bad model that I do not want to see replicated in society at large.
Well, we need these institutions, I think, still as a society, because a lot of important work, a lot of important research is done in these institutions. And I think what I've noticed happening in the last couple of years is this agenda, it doesn't seem to have a finish line, right? It doesn't seem to have a destination. I was talking to a student named Sam, who goes to Vanderbilt, and he's the soon-to-be president of the College Republicans there. And I was asking him to, you know, tell me a little bit about campus life on a recent show. And I said, I don't think you shutting up, you being polite, giving these people what they want is any kind of a solution, because I think there's always another step. But the slippery slope was a logical fallacy before these people basically seemed to turn it into a tactic.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I've thought the same thing, by the way, about there's no, you can't imagine a point at which this sort of person says, okay, society is just the way I want it. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine. They're looking for forms of oppression that you need a microscope to see.
Right.
You think of genuine, actual oppression as it exists in the world, and then you compare it to where these people are finding oppression. It's a caricature. It diminishes what real oppression really is. We should be using an altogether different word to describe it. So, and by the way, you know, I graduated from college in 1994, and we had craziness on the campuses, but it wasn't like this, and it certainly wasn't. It wasn't to the point where everybody was just in sheer terror. They better not say the wrong thing, or they are not a member of the human race anymore. I mean, there was a little bit of that, but it wasn't just this suffocating, overwhelming feeling. And this is why it was so interesting to be at this Yale event tonight, because we were all, you know, talking about myself and people in the party of the right, were saying things that if you say them, you are evil, oppressive, racist, whatever, even though nothing we said had anything to do with race whatsoever, but obviously right. That doesn't matter to these people. And it's the sort of thing that you would be just shunned for, and yet everybody got along.
Outside of what we saw tonight, why do you think things are worse versus when you were in college in the 90s?
Honestly, I don't know what has happened. I can't make sense of how it's just gotten completely out of control. It seems to me like the numbers on the ground are the same. The professors are in the same proportion progressive as they were before. I guess the difference is that progressivism never stands still in the same way that, you know, we were saying that these people never get to a point where they say, okay, everything's fine. It never stands still. And as they have to look for ever, ever narrower forms of oppression, it seems like they get more shrill as the source of the oppression gets more small. As they should be getting happier, they get angrier in the same proportion. I can't make sense of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You've had Jonathan Haidt on your show, I think, a couple of times, and I thought you guys had some really, really good discussions about some of the phenomenon. I mean, I think about what we see so much showing up on YouTube or in social media with a lot of this identity politics and campus activism. It seems to be like a confluence of factors running together. I absolutely agree with what you're saying about, you know, progressive, you know, it's a long march, continuous march forward. That's an aspect of it. But I think there's some interesting generational considerations. And I think the technology of today allows for people, if they want to be more insular, more shielded, more in their own echo chamber. You know, one of the things that I like about the left is it's kind of an instructive mirror for libertarians, for the libertarian movement. Their mistakes are so glaring. You know, like lots of libertarians have their vision of a utopian society. Well, these people do too. And if you get too fixated on that, I think the rest of the world really starts to look pretty crappy when you compare it to your utopia. And I've seen libertarians do it, and I've seen these leftists do it. And what it results in is alienation and resentment towards everything in the world. And it produces that kind of shrillness. And then there's you couple that with the insularity and just the challenges of being in this generation. It's no fault of their own, but they've never had to wait for anything. You remember waiting in a line at Blockbuster Video to rent a movie? You know, they don't. They never had that like delay of gratification. So it's like, I really see it as like a confluence of things coming together to produce this.
And then you add that together with the fact that it can feel very satisfying to portray yourself and think of yourself as being morally superior to other people. And this kind of progressivism gives people ample opportunity to do that. I'm better than you because I hold this view and you hold that view. I'm better than you because I see oppression and this, that, or the other thing. And everybody else is backward and stupid and oppressive and evil and wicked. And that becomes like a drug. Like, you need more of that. I need this feeling of superiority. So it's a very twisted, very unfortunate thing to get caught up in. And I know not everybody on the left goes quite this far, but certainly they don't do enough to speak out against this sort of people. But as I say, you know, I'm totally zonked and exhausted after it, but I'm still kind of in this brief, temporary, all too temporary feeling of, well, I was just a part of something tonight that if I were to just go by what YouTube tells me, this should be impossible.
Yeah.
That we actually had a civil discussion about a controversial thing and everybody afterwards shook hands and said it was a great time. I don't see why that's so rare to the point where I've never seen it happen anywhere else.
You know, you were talking before, I do want to say more about the event tonight, but you're talking about this moral superiority that these leftists seek. You know, I have to say, as somebody who came from the left, I think, like, looking back at it and able to kind of reflect on my past, honestly, that was a big part of what attracted me to libertarianism. Like, the left is very much about shame, right? And shaming people, like, oh, don't you know about what Howard Zinn said here? And how can you have your head buried in the sand? And all these things. But if you want really good shame tools, I mean, the non-aggression principle, you know, and that
everybody's
was so,
guilty.
It was an easy transition to come from the left to, once you hear these arguments, like, these are way better. These are way more powerful tools than the left has a lot of tools.
But you know what's interesting, though? The difference there is that for most of us anyway, let's say the less obnoxious among us.
Yeah.
We realize that, or our point is generally that deep down, a lot of people get the basic idea of the non-aggression principle and they live their lives according to it without really ever articulating it fully. And our point is simply that what they've missed is that there is another part of their lives, namely the part that involves politics, in which they are regularly abandoning this principle that they accept in every other aspect of their lives. And so our view is that, you know, largely through no fault of their own, they've just got this bifurcated mind where on the one hand they believe in non-aggression, but on the other hand, when it comes to politics, they don't. And we simply just want to bring to their attention this contradiction and try and resolve it for them. So we don't have this view that you are a reprobate and you can never be reached. It's more a question of, let's draw out maybe Socratically what it is that you already believe, what we already share in common. And I just want to show you that you should extend that farther. I think there's something that's inherently friendlier and less confrontational about our shame tools, as you call them, you know, than these other ones.
No, I agree. And I think it was, you learn how to wield them more responsibly and more gently and more compassionately the longer you have these beliefs. When all this stuff is new, it's like, look out. I poison so many wells with people on political topics, just being a new libertarian, that I would walk into a room and I would hear people change the subject because they would do that because they didn't want to have the conversation with me because they felt like I was so abrasive and so pedantic about it and so sure that I was, you know, right and superior to them. So like I said, you know, I think there's lots of mirrors in the left as we look for better ways to take our ideas and communicate them in a reasonable way, in a way that's going to reach other people. I like to watch these people, not because I think it's hilarious and fun or low-hanging fruit, but I see a lot of myself in that mindset. I hate to say it. I hate to admit it.
I get that. And let me add something that I've said before. It's not the case that if you are really aggressive with people, that necessarily always fails.
Because
sometimes you get them thinking and they get frustrated because they can't really answer you and you're being so insistent. And sometimes that plants a seed with people. Like in my case, I didn't become a libertarian or I started off as being like an anti-war conservative and then I became a libertarian. And I didn't become those things because somebody sat me down and said, "Now, Tom, let me show how your principles contradict the things you're support." No, I was told, look, you're supporting morally outrageous things. You should be ashamed of yourself and look at the reality of the situation. And you're just repeating ridiculous conservative talking points that bear no connection to reality. Wake up. You're abandoning the principles that you say you believe in. Like, it was people who did the rhetorical equivalent of grabbing me by the collar and shaking me.
Yeah.
And so that's why I don't reproach myself for being tough with people sometimes, because sometimes people will say, well, Woods, you got to be a little bit kinder. Well, okay, some people need kindness and they need a massage and strawberries and cream or whatever. And maybe some people can give them that. And some of my stuff will give them that. But I know for a fact, because I was one of them, that some people need to be, you know, smacked in the head rhetorically.
I totally agree. And I think there needs to be a kind of division of labor with that, right? Like, different people have different kinds of communication styles, and there's no right answer. Like, there's lots of people out there that I think we could connect with who we haven't connected yet, but there is certainly not one way to do it. You know, I bet your approach does. I've tried to look for that softer approach, but I honestly can't say how effective it's been.
Yeah. And the thing is that you really can't know in the long run.
That's true. Yeah.
Always how many people you've influenced, because maybe you influence somebody who comes to agree with you 10 years later. In fact, yeah. I remember being in college, and I was a freshman, and I was debating a guy. He was an American who had moved to Egypt at age 5 because his father was a diplomat. But he was American, but he was basically Egyptian culturally. And he did not at all support. This was the 1990 going into 1991. This was the Operation Desert Storm, the first Iraq war. And I was all in favor of it. Why? Because I was a Republican and the Republicans were in favor of it. And
right,
so
right.
I went along and I found the arguments in favor and I supported them. And he was just telling me every which way how wrong I was. And we just he just couldn't get over how wrong I was. And I just thought he was some dopey idiot. And then years later, I thought, you know, geez, and I just the world just no longer seemed to conform to my talking points. And I thought, doggone it, that guy was right. And I never had an opportunity to see him again. And then one day I was walking down the street in Boston and I just ran into him at random. And I said, look, it's great to see you and everything, but I need to tell you something. You were totally right about the foreign policy stuff. You were completely right. I was completely wrong, and I can't tell you how satisfying it is to see you in person and be able to tell you that. And he never sugarcoated it with me. He would say, "Man, come on now. Look at these atrocities you're supporting. Man, you're better than that. Man, come on now." And, you know, and he wasn't writing me. He wasn't delivering beautiful soliloquies and writing me sonnets. He was hitting me over the head.
Right.
But again, how could he have known? He would never even have known that any of that did any good if I hadn't just purely at random of all the millions of people who could have been walking down that street, I just happened to see him and told him. You know, and it's the same principle, by the way, for that English teacher you had in ninth grade, you know, who assigned you Sinclair Lewis that you didn't really read. You read the Cliff Notes and that was the end of it.
Right.
And then you see him years later. You got to tell that teacher, listen, you know, I grew up and later on I went ahead and I read that Sinclair Lewis book and it really wasn't half bad.
Right.
So it wasn't totally wasted on me. People do appreciate that, you know.
Sure. You know, you wrote an email a few months ago and I read it in one of my shows. It was about talking to the left.
Oh, yeah. I got in trouble for that.
This was actually a really controversial thing on my show. And what I said at the time when I first read it, it was in part one of a series I did called Speed in Politics, which was trying to explain the post-election hysteria through like a psychological lens. And I said, well, you know, I came from the left and I'm glad people were willing to talk to me. 3 months later, I said, you know what? Tom Woods was right. I said, because of the very thing that I talked about with this generation, people are too quick and too deep in their own battle stations now. Right. So it becomes very, very hard. And we can see this in all of these, instances on college campuses. And the only thing that I would change, the only thing that I would want elaborated out of that is what do we mean by the left? Because I think most people, because we live in a society where, you know, public school runs to the left, mainstream media, mainstream news runs to the left, Hollywood runs to the left, Google, Facebook, all of these institutions that are so important in people's lives lean to the left. And because public school produces minds that are generally apathetic when it comes to politics, most people just grow up and they drift to the left without really thinking about it. I had some conversation about funding for the arts with somebody who I'd always thought, who I'd never talked about with politics with before. And I had always thought she was totally reasonable until we had this conversation. She was like, well, yeah, but, you know, funding for the arts, right? I said, no funding for the arts. But that was just the result of never really thinking about these things. So there are a lot of people. My point is that they're casually on the left. You know, they're not these.
Yeah. Yeah. Those people you can talk to.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the people. Their whole identity is wrapped up in being on the left.
Sure.
Almost none of them can be talked to. Now, again, there are exceptions. I had Ralph Nader on my show, and it was perfectly pleasant. It was fine. It was wonderful. I mean, partly because we hate the same people. I mean, that's a great conversation starter. But I'm talking about people. See, the difference between left and right, and no, I don't believe people who say there's no such thing as left and right. Yes, there is. So I don't agree with you. But the difference is the left has these words they can use against you that can destroy your career and your life. If they call you a racist or a whatever else they could call it. Now white supremacist is the new term for racist because that one got old. Nobody believes it anymore because they use it all the time. So now it's white supremacist. So that's the new word. But, you know, and then there's sexism and everything, you know, everybody's a bigot or they're a this-a-phobe or that-a-phobe. Now, the right wing, they sometimes use anti-Semite against people. The left does that too. But by and large, it's really the left has these words that they can use and they poison conversations with them. The right doesn't have that. They pathetically try to call the left bigots because they're anti-Christian. That just rolls right off them. Yeah. There's no leftist who thinks, oh my goodness, my job's at stake because I'm a Christophobe. You know, that, right. No one feels that way. That's what I mean, that it's hard to talk to them because they're so ready to use words and like this that they think end the discussion. And instead, these words are a substitute for discussion. And that's what I mean about how frustrating it is and why I mean, I personally think I could convert 10, 15 people on the right over in the time it would take me to even get a word in edgewise with somebody on the left. So, yeah, I mean, if you have that kind of spare time and that kind of unique talent, then be my guest. You know, I was on my show recently. I pointed out that maybe he listens to your show, but there is a drama queen on Facebook. I probably shouldn't mention his name. Who got all dramatic that I had said this about the left. And he's all weeping tears about how he was on the left. And it's a good thing the libertarian movement wasn't all full of Tom Woodses because this way, you know.
I wonder if that's my friend who's very bombastic online, by the way. Yeah. And I was joking with him because he's more of a left libertarian, but like sort of just around the bend. And we've done a lot of shows together. And I said, you know, I was going through his wall looking for something because we were going to talk about it on a show. And I was like, we have to do a series called Explain Your Post, you know, because some of your posts are just like, what is.
Well, this was like F this and F that and F Tom Woods and whatever. I thought, gee, I mean, first of all, like just this whole thing of I've got to proclaim to the world my reaction to. My response to that is, number one, it's people on the left themselves who come to me and say, Woods, your only problem is you're not tough enough on these people. I know because I used to be one of them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and by the way, you think I haven't been tough on, you know what I used to be? I was a neocon. You think I haven't been tough on the neocons? I wrote a whole book, almost a whole, I mean, my book, Real Dissent, is almost entirely on the neocons. And if anything, I am much more vicious on the neocons. So I'm much more vicious on my former self. And I didn't then write myself a letter saying, well, good thing I didn't have to come in contact with Tom Woods or I would never have converted. No, it's because I know how rotten these people are that I'm as tough as I am with them.
Yeah. Maybe he was just using the name Tom Woods. And maybe I'm entirely responsible for this because I read your email on my show once.
Yeah, maybe so.
Maybe Tom Woods was just kind of embodying this idea that is kind of what I see as being part of the problem is that people go to their battle stations and they don't talk anymore. And like there is something that is a little bit unattractive about saying, I'm not going to talk to these because there's a lot of this in New Hampshire, right? There are a lot of the free staters, they don't talk to normal people.
Right.
And, you know, not talking, as you've pointed out, with these people who shut down these discussions on the left leads to more aggressive types of interactions. So right. I think it might be a kind of warning to say, well, let's delegate somebody to talk to these people.
Yeah, and that's fine. The thing is that it can't be me because although I have brought some people over from the left without particularly trying, just by doing my regular thing, the problem is, as I say, because the left is addicted now to this language, this demonizing language that just ends and shuts down productive discussion, why is this something I would want to pursue? I mean, I'm going to have my name dragged through the mud if I'm going to debate these people. Forget it. You know, at least the conservatives, for all their faults and all the terrible policies they support, they don't do that to me. I can talk to them and it's not like within 5 seconds they say, wait a minute, are you a racist? I read three sentences you wrote 25 years ago and I – what the, you know, who acts like that? That is not normal. That is not how human beings ought to be interacting with each other. These people are decent to me. They listen to what I have to say, and some of them change their minds. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm upset that I can't even have conversations with people who all they want to do is demonize. And if you're going to pretend that's not happening on the left, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, well, no one should be pretending this. I mean, they're the worst at that, absolutely. Now, with this more casual left, this person who's just kind of been, to a certain extent, a victim is a strong word, but they've been kind of a casualty of a left-leaning culture and a public school system that made them sort of politically and philosophically apathetic. So they've drifted into this place. They really don't know why they're there. They say things like, cause FDR, you know, that's a reason. If you could take one piece of your work, whether it was a podcast that you can think of off the top of your head or a book or an article, and give to people like that, because I bet there's a lot of people in my audience who'd have that question. If I could take one thing and give it to this person who's just casually wandered over there to ignite their interest in this topic and persuade them quickly, is there something that you've done that comes to mind for that kind of person?
Folks, I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Brett Vanat, but because we are libertarians and we believe in contracts, here is a quick word from our sponsor. I drive my family crazy and have fun doing it, by the way, by telling them that the store brand is just as good as the name brand. And they're telling me, get out of town. Come on, we all know the store brand stinks. Now, they admit that for things like salt, it doesn't really matter what the brand is. But they say, for things that matter, you gotta get the real brand. Well, I think that is a good general principle. For things that matter, you gotta look out for quality. For example, sleeping, you gotta have a good mattress. But also, your shave. You do that every day. There's a potential you could be making yourself into a bloody mess. And it conveys a look to people. It makes you look either professional or hopeless. It makes you comfortable or miserable and stingy. So you got to get the best. What's the best? Harry's. I have been using Harry's razors with tremendous results. Vastly better than blades I've used in the past. I gave up on blades. Wouldn't even use them anymore. Smooth, close, comfortable, beautiful. And yet, you won't pay outrageous prices for it. And in fact, they're going to give you a free trial set for nothing. Just pay a tiny shipping fee, and they're going to send you the razor handle of your choice, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. It's free when you sign up. That's how confident Harry's is in the quality of their blades. Want to redeem this free trial offer? Go to harrys.com/woods.
If you could take one piece of your work and give it to this person who's just casually wandered over there to ignite their interest in this topic and persuade them quickly, is there something that you've done that comes to mind for that kind of person?
Yeah, I'll have to look up the episode numbers. There are 2 episodes of my show that are really just recordings of speeches that I've given. And one of them was like a speech I gave at the Mises Institute to a group of high schoolers and homeschoolers who had come for a 1-day seminar. And I basically said, here's the half-hour speech I would give to the whole world if I had their attention about why the free market matters. So that's one. I guess there's also one. There's one I gave to the Texas Libertarian Party, and it was called The Libertarian Speech I Would Deliver to the Whole World. That one's on YouTube. Then the other one is, I think this is the best speech I've ever given. And I remember Judge Napolitano was in the audience, and it just gave me such satisfaction that it went over so well, that it really, I delivered it so well. Because he loved it too. And it's called 4 Things the State Is Not. Because we have, and I actually don't even remember what all 4 of them are, because the state isn't those things, so I've forgotten. But one of them is, you know, the state is not this dispassionate public service agency that has no interests of its own, that's just dispassionately looking after your own good. It is anything in the world but that. And so I go through and give examples, because these are the sorts of things that, as you say, a casual person who's not giving this a lot of thought, they would think that, right? Well, these are my elected officials, and they're trying to do what's best for me and provide for the common good. And I just go through and just give example after example. This is not the way you should think about it. And that's, I think, because it addresses the way somebody might by default think, I think it's the most effective thing I've ever done in terms of public speaking.
Yeah, and I think there's a real need for that. Because, I mean, do you agree that most people are that? They're just people who, you know, they wander in front of a TV, CNN is on, MSNBC is on, they kind of interface with current events through headlines that come up in their Facebook news feed. I'm getting like political messages from Windows 10, you know, like the news stories that it's feeding me are all very like agenda driven, anti-Trump, I find. I don't have like political spectrum settings on there. Those are just the stories that, you know, Microsoft Edge feeds me through Windows 10. So it's understandable how people wind up in this position.
Oh, yeah.
And it's most people.
And it's not even, I mean, it's also corporate America very reliably repeats left-wing talking points. My favorite recent example was Audi did a video about the gender pay gap.
Yeah.
And of course, I've done stuff on the gender pay gap. I don't believe in any of that stuff, but they did this video and then somebody pointed out, well, let's see, what are women earning at Audi and what are men earning at your very company? And can you believe the response they gave was, well, when you factor in the differences in what women and men do at Audi, you'll see why that. Yeah, that's the explanation everywhere. Yeah. That's the same explanation 3 seconds ago you weren't willing to accept from any other private employer. But all of a sudden, when the spotlight is on you, that's the excuse you're going to give. They were utterly demolished, which is great. But most people only see the propaganda. They never get to see the demolition.
And why is there that pandering? Because the corporation is obviously going to be the friend of people on the right. So they have to pander to people on the left.
I think I think the corporation feels like it gets a bad rap from people on the left. And people on the right, they're going to win over anyway because they're corporations. I think that's the way they think. So we might as well do the outreach to the people we need to do the outreach to. I think there is some of that.
Absolutely. So look, I'm exhausted and I'm going to get out of here in a minute. Last question.
Okay.
Favorite part of the night? What was the best thing that you saw there at Yale?
Okay. Well, I mean, I hope we were able to get video. The mics weren't working. Who knows? They say the audio came out reasonably okay, but my favorite moment was after I had spoken, I had taken questions, and then student after student after student came up and spoke, and some were for me and some were against me, and some weren't quite sure. But I was taking notes through the whole thing, and then they give me some time to respond. And I feel like the response part was my strongest part of the night, because I addressed people who were just, it wasn't just a matter of opinion. They made assertions that were incorrect. It was great to not just enjoy ourselves and not just marvel at how wonderful it is that we could all be civil while debating something controversial. It was also nice to have the satisfaction of knowing, yeah, I smashed this out of the park, and that feels darn good to do that at Yale University.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, the first part where you get up there and you spoke probably for about 20 minutes, and then you sit down and I say, this guy got on a plane for that? Is that it? Is that all that's going to happen? I knew there'd be some Q&A.
Right.
But I was totally blindsided by, I'm not an Ivy Leaguer myself, so I had never seen this kind
and
of discussion format.
And I didn't know exactly the format either.
Right, right. So I guess they've been doing this since the 1930s.
Yeah, this is really old, and they do it every single Tuesday. But then... The closing statement made the whole thing worthwhile to me. I was so glad to be able to do that, and I did it in a kind of roast style at the beginning. I got up and I said, "Well, you know, Brian such and such is a guy who really made all the arrangements and my transportation. So, you know, you'd think I'd be a little bit more charitable than to get up here and demolish his terrible arguments, but I have to." You know, it was that kind of talk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And everybody loved it and laughed, and it was great.
And then the you did some just meet and greet with people afterwards, and there was a guy, he went up there, and I thought he was acting. And then he came up to you after. He goes, "Oh no, I'm a total neocon. I helped Donald Rumsfeld write a book."
Yeah,
and that's then you
right.
guys had a back and forth, a continuation. Like he seemed like he had more he wanted to say to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This was an interesting guy who I actually said in my closing thing, I thought he had made the most intelligent comments of the night.
Yeah,
and he was very flattered by that. But he said, "Look, you are looking at a Washington neocon in the flesh." And I thought, shudder. but we did, you know, we had a pleasant enough chat. But when he told me that, you know, the type of person he'd go see speak is Donald Rumsfeld, I just thought, oh, my goodness, I don't even know where to begin with you. But you're right. It was wonderful. I had a lot of supporters in the audience from Yale and not from Yale. And I had a couple who had driven from Virginia to come up and support me. I mean, and people had driven from Boston. I mean, you know, you came in from New Hampshire, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, I mean, this is that's amazing.
Yeah. I had some of my audience here, too, that I got to meet for the first time.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah, yeah. I saw, you were talking to people like you had known them forever, and you just met them tonight.
I did. Yeah. It was very, very cool. So what's next for you?
Other than going to bed because it's 1 a.m.
Exactly.
I get up at 7 this morning, which for me is extremely early. Well, I have a couple of little things that I'm finishing. My friend Mark Thornton is coming out with a book on some of the great work he's done. He's such a great economist, and I'm writing the foreword to that. with me right now, I'm pretty much kind of content with how things are going. Later this year, I will be hitting episode 1,000 of the Tom Woods Show. So I'm looking to, I'd like to arrange a live in-person event for episode 1,000. I'd like to make this big and have some fun with it. So I have to figure that out. I mean, would people come to that? I don't know. I would be inclined to do it in Florida because that's where I'm living now. I'll probably keep putting out the old, you know, I put out free ebooks a lot. I'll keep doing that. And there's a decent likelihood that in the next year or so, I'll be doing a co-authoring a book on the war on terror that basically refutes it systematically, then just shows that there are no grounds on which you can support this. It fails indeed, on every conceivable ground you could possibly defend it on. So that one, even though I don't really have much desire to write any more books, I mean, they drain me in every way, physically and mentally. But this one, I just feel morally compelled to do. And yeah, there have been books attacking this or that part of it, but I want systematic. I want every country that's been involved with it, I want to talk about and smack it down. So that'll be another project. But basically, I'm just going to do more of the same. I like doing my podcast. I like doing Contra Krugman. I like doing the cruise that I do every year with Bob Murphy. I like doing my online entrepreneurship stuff. I do a lot of stuff that keeps me busy, just staying up with my regular stuff. So adding anything extra onto that, it's making me tired just thinking about it.
Well, the two times that I was on your show, I noticed that you were concerned about how many episodes I had compared to you. And I'm you'll be happy to learn that this year you will double me.
Wow.
When did you start the show?
September 2013.
Okay, so, and you started years after I did.
But I mean, I'm doing it five times a week. That's crazy. No, that's not normal.
So if I have you in the room, and I don't ask you this before I leave, my listeners will egg my house. Do you have some kind of method to your productivity? Is there some kind of secret formula that Tom Woods has? Because you do. I mean, you get a ton of stuff done.
You know, I actually did an episode called something like My Productivity Secret or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was probably the only clickbaity title I've ever really used. Because my titles, they might be provocative, but I deliver on them.
Yeah.
This one was clickbaity because when you listen to it, it turns out my productivity secret is work yourself to exhaustion, sacrifice everything that's dear to you, make yourself miserable, and don't sleep. That's my secret. So when you hear that, you say, well, I'm not even sure I wanted to know that. So I will say that I have recovered from that. I'm not in that mode any longer. But now I look at what I do, and I honestly don't feel like I do that much. I mean, yeah, I do an episode a day, but the episode is between a half an hour and an hour.
Yeah.
Compare that to a guy doing roofing in 100-degree Alabama heat, and I got it made. I mean, I put out an occasional ebook, but I mean, the thing is, with me, it's just that I've gotten able to, because I've done this for so long, I can do things fast. I can write fast. I can write a daily email newsletter really quickly. And in fact, I have two different email lists. I have one on libertarianism and I have one on earning money online, which is about as difficult as falling off a log, as my friend Ben Settle says. Yep. So I feel like people are just letting opportunities pass them by constantly. So I'm constantly sharing with people, this is what I do. Here's another thing I found. Now I'm doing this and whatever. I remember, by the way, I know this isn't what you asked me, but there's a guy named Pat Flynn who has a Smart Passive Income podcast.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And when I saw how Pat Flynn was earning his money, and I realized he was earning $40,000 per month as an affiliate of Bluehost web hosting, my first thought was, I'm getting a piece of that. There ain't no way I am not getting a piece of that. So I developed a thing where if you use my affiliate link, I give you four unbelievably helpful bonuses that will give you free traffic and all kinds of stuff from me. And so everybody wants that. Who wouldn't? And then I get a commission. So I mean, I'm interested in stuff like that. I know some people aren't. I don't understand why they're not, because that's like the easiest money I possibly earn.
Sure.
It takes me 3 seconds to do the thing I need to do, and I earn a commission for that. Like, why would I not want to? So I have an email list dedicated to that too, and I do that every day. But I just enjoy it so much. It goes quickly. I can do it really fast. And then if I do anything above and beyond that these days, I'm not killing myself. I'm not saying, well, this has got to be done by April 12th or whatever. I do my regular stuff every day, and if there's time left over, I work on a little outside project here and there. But I used to just kill myself with self-imposed deadlines. Or what I would do – here's some perverse thing that I used to do, Brett. I would have three deadlines, and I would deliberately do the one that was farther out first – because I knew that I would get them all done one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I would just make it as hard on myself as possible, so that when the really urgent one comes up, I really got it. I mean, I was just the things I was doing to myself. Like, I would add stuff to my plate because I knew I would never say to somebody, "I'm sorry, I can't deliver." I knew I would always do it. So it would just be a question of, let's see how I can get it done. Let's see how. This is not possible, but since I've committed to it, I know it'll get done. Let's see how I wind up doing it. I mean, it was perverse. I mean, if you're a workaholic, you're a sick, twisted bastard. That really is what becomes of you. And now it's just a matter of, I do my regular thing. I'm in a routine. You get into a routine. You get good at something. You can produce a lot quickly. And then, if I have a little spare time, I work on something else. If not, not.
When you were pushing yourself like that, did you have this, Tom, like this state in mind? Like, this is what I'm working towards, or this is what I imagine I'm working towards?
At the beginning, no. It was, I always kind of envisioned myself as constantly working.
You thought there'd be no end to it.
Yeah, I kind of did. I thought there'd be no end to it. Ugh. But I thought, this is how I thrive, you know, is by work and by, you know, constantly proving myself or whatever. Because ever since I've been in like middle school, I always felt like I had to prove myself because I was the dorky kid and
sure.
People didn't want to hang around with me and they didn't realize how funny I was, right? I'm kind of funny. Why right. Don't you want to hang around with
right.
me? So I had to prove myself in that way. And I always, you know, and then I would always be insecure, even like now, like if people go to lunch, do they really want me to come along? Was I explicitly invited? I'm always doubting myself. So I would use productivity and work as a way to validate myself in my own eyes and other people's eyes. And you know, then I got to this when I did the Ron Paul curriculum and I did 400 history videos for that. And that was murder. It was the most impossible project in the history of the world. It took me 2 years of nonstop work. It was so much work, it crushed my spirit. And I actually began to think, you know, when this is over, I think I don't want to do this anymore. And so I don't push my – people always write to me. They say, Woods, you got to write a book on X, Y, or Z. And I feel like, you know, somebody else has to pick up the slack now.
Sure.
So now I've gone from I used to resent going on vacation to I am lovingly planning my vacations 6 months in advance.
Right.
I've gotten to where I need to be spiritually. Boy, this took a weird turn toward the end.
I think this is like one of the most important subjects in my audience. And this is one of those things that is not taught in school. Productivity. And what is the approach? Is it this, you know, grind yourself down so you can relax later? And there's sort of a stoic appeal to that, I guess, you know, that walking through the fire to get to the...
Yeah, you know, I guess there is one aspect of that I was trying to do, which was I wanted to get to a point where I wouldn't have to travel constantly to support the family. I'd be able to generate income from home doing the sorts of things that I do. And with stuff like affiliate marketing, which I do, and if I may be perfectly blunt, I am pretty darn good at, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That has made it possible for me to have 10 times the lifestyle I used to have without running myself ragged flying all over the country. And it lets me do something I love doing, which is my podcast every day. So that's why I want to help people figure out how they can do what I'm doing, because it sure is making me happy.
Absolutely. So I didn't know about this other list you had. How do people get on that?
The best free ebook I've written. I wrote this from scratch. It's called Five Paths to an Online Income, and it shows the five different things that I do, like selling things as an affiliate. Like, I sell the Ron Paul curriculum as an affiliate. Mm-hmm. I sell Bluehost web hosting as an affiliate, and I show people exactly how to do that, how to do it effectively, how to get people to want to order from you and your link. But I've also self-published books and whatever. So I've got five different things that I've done, and I have all the experience in the world. I know exactly how to do it step by step. So if you feel like I don't even know where to begin, I wrote this ebook about it. And so you can pick that up at a website called pathstoincome.com. And the price of the ebook is you get on my email list. But it's a good email list. You won't want to you can easily unsubscribe from it, but you won't want to, because I want people on that list who get it, who are excited, who want to do stuff, you know, who want to figure out, hey, you know, I can make an extra $200 a week or something doing X or Y, optimizing my website, or you know, doing this affiliate thing. Yeah, I want people who think that's awesome, because I mm-hmm. think that's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing how many different ways there are, like how many different places there are to look, right? To develop, I think to go from that scarcity mindset, which plagues so many of us, to being able to say, this is what I want, and this is, and finding the way to get it. Just some, if it means changing up a strategy, right? Maybe people say, I don't have this thing. Or maybe you just don't have the right strategy. Maybe that's what's in between you and that thing. It's not, you know, actually that you going and earning the money. It's you don't have the best plan, or you don't have the best approach to doing it.
Right.
All right. Now I'm truly exhausted.
Yeah. It's almost 1 a.m., which, I mean, 1 a.m. is not so bad, but given that I've got to be in a car heading to the airport at 6 a.m.
Exactly. Exactly. And I've got to be in a car definitely by in 10 minutes. I really appreciate you making this possible. And I really, really enjoyed everything that I saw tonight. I thought that was a fantastic event. So thanks for being on the show and thanks for coming up to New England.
Well, I'm so glad you made this drive all the way to come to the event. I was very glad to have you there. I was glad we had time to have dinner and talk and then sit in my hotel room until 1 a.m. recording a podcast episode. You know, these are the sorts of things that don't happen to me all the time. So
yeah, that's terrific.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. Please don't go yet, because I want to tell you about something that will possibly help you if you are looking to start a blog or a website. I want to give you a great example of what a really nice one looks like. And it's clarioncafe.com, C-L-A-R-I-O-N, clarioncafe.com. Before I even tell you what it's about, just look at the layout of this site. Very clean, not cluttered, simple, yet elegant. That is exactly what you ought to be shooting for. I think sometimes people try to stuff too much on the screen because they think the more I put on the screen, the more things people have to click on, the better I'll do. But people get overwhelmed. They don't click in the first place because they don't even know where to begin. This site even has a start here button. Very smart. So I am a big, big booster of clarioncafe.com. The site is devoted mostly to coffee guides, articles, and reviews. And it also features subjects relating to the music world from the perspective of a classically trained musician. Over time, you'll be able to use this site as a resource for all your coffee brewing and equipment needs. And you may also discover musical insights you might otherwise not have been aware of. So if you love coffee and you don't mind the occasional musical topic, this site is for you. And of course, it was created by a listener of the show. So, tremendous. Check it out, clarioncafe.com. Support a listener. And remember, of course, you get a nice shout out like this too. If you use my link when you get your web hosting, you get a nice big initial torrent of traffic right out of the gate, which is exactly what a new website or blog needs, plus three other major bonuses that are going to put a big smile on your face. Check them all out at tomwoods.com/publicity, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.